for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Members of the Electoral College meet in the states today to cast their votes for president and vice president. Dozens of electors have been flooded with letters and emails asking them not to vote for President-elect Trump. And more than 50 Democratic electors ask for an intelligence briefing on Russian interference in the election. Here to talk about so-called faithless electors and the 2016 presidential election, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Danielle Kurtzleben of NPR. Joining us from a studio in Louisville, Kentucky, Gary Gregg of the University of Louisville. Throughout the hour, we'll invite your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And thank you all so much for joining us today.
Good morning, Diane. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Diane.
Danielle, I'll start with you. Take us through the mechanics. The electors do not all meet in one place. Where are they? How are they chosen?
Right. So the electors today in all 50 states plus D.C. will be meeting, well, except for in D.C., in state capitals or office buildings maybe around the Capitol. But it is dictated in the Constitution that they meet in their states. Those electors in general were chosen by their political parties in their states. So when we all went to the polls on November 8th, when you checked the box or whatever for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you weren't choosing the candidate. You were choosing the electors that the parties in your state have chosen to represent your state on the, and I want to get this right, the Monday following the second Wednesday in December. And that is today, and that is enshrined in federal law as the day that the Electoral College does its voting.
I gather there have only been 9 faithless electors in 100 years.
Right, yeah. Overall, Fair Vote, which is a voting advocacy organization, has counted up 157 in total over the history of the U.S., but it is very rare, and it has grown increasingly rare. In fact, the last faithless elector that there was, quote-unquote faithless, was in 2004. It was an anonymous elector from Minnesota who voted for John Edwards instead of for John Kerry. And there are many people who wonder if maybe that was just an honest mistake as opposed to, you know, some sort of a odd protest vote.
Because I think that elector voted for Kerry for vice president, if
really?
I remember right.
Oh, really?
Somebody correct me out there, but
oh,
I think he flipped
sake.
The ticket.
Yeah.
Now,
or she.
29 states bind their electors. Is that correct?
Yes, plus the District of Columbia here. But this is really interesting because these states have these laws that say, yes, you need to vote for who the people in your state voted for. However, it's not entirely clear whether those laws are constitutional. And there are plenty of constitutional law scholars who disagree on this, who say, you know, listen, the Constitution and the founders really did say the electors can choose who they vote for no matter what. So it is a big question whether someone could actually prosecute an elector for voting, quote unquote, their conscience.
All right. And EJ, you say these electors should think hard before handing Trump the presidency. Why?
Well, I think more than any single thing, it's this news that we have been studying over the last couple of weeks that the Russians kind of hacked our election and intervened with the express purpose, according to the CIA, of making Donald Trump our president. And there is a wonderful passage in Federalist 68 that everybody, that document that everybody's been quoting, the Hamilton electors, where Hamilton said that the electors could be a barrier against, quotes, the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. And then he has this wonderful line, how could they better gratify this than by raising a creature of their own to the chief magistracy, sorry about that, of the Union. And now, I think that this is a serious matter. And at the very least, if enough electors bolted from Trump, you could force it into the House of Representatives and have a little more time to ponder this. Having said all that, this would be an enormous disruption of the system, and that the tradition, not in the Constitution, by the way, and we can talk about that as the show goes on, but the tradition since 1828 and by state law is that electors follow the wishes of their state voters. That's generally a good idea in principle, although, and I'm sure we'll get to this, I have long believed the Electoral College needed to be scrapped entirely and replaced with a popular vote, if I may. Just one more fact. We only had a discrepancy between the plurality winner of the popular vote and the Electoral College three times from 1788 to 1996. And in two of those, they were very peculiar elections, 1824 and 1876. This has happened to us now twice since 2000. And given population movements in the country toward metro areas, it's almost certainly going to happen more often now. And that's why I think we really have to reconsider this system. And again, just to underscore it, I felt this long before the Donald Trump experience of this year.
But both candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and all the others knew before this election began that the Electoral College rules were in place. So how can you say now that they should think hard before they vote for Donald Trump?
Well, some of this obviously hangs on how you view Donald Trump. What I wrote in the column you referenced is that, yes, it would be a huge disruption of our system if this happened. But I also think Donald Trump himself is a huge disruption and perhaps danger to our system. So in this case, my view of this very much hangs on the nature of Donald Trump. I make no bones about that. But also on the information that we've gotten both a little bit before and in even more detail after the election, there are some disturbing things that happened. And again, in that column, I take very seriously the idea that this is not a normal thing. But I think that in Trump's case, it is worth electors thinking twice. And I think you've seen in this round far more agitation about the issue of whether electors should exercise their conscience than you did before. Even in 2000, with the great controversy over Florida, we had nothing like the conversation that we're having now about the electors exercising their independent judgment.
Mm-hmm. Gary Gregg, do these electors have the right to vote their conscience?
Well, Diane, if we take the founding's vision seriously on this constitutionally, I think they do have the right to, and that's a good way to put it. As I've thought about this, so Hamilton clearly outlines a deliberative process, and I think that's what the founders intended. They were to meet today. If what the Electoral College functioned as it was intended today, you would have some theoretically smart, virtuous, good people elected by the state legislature somehow in the state. They would meet today, and they would talk about it. They would talk about the candidates. They would talk about what they knew about them. They would talk about the needs of the country and then vote for a fit person for president, as Hamilton said. It doesn't work that way anymore. So I think they still have the right to deliberate and to think. But we've also democratized in American history. So this over the course of American history, and we have democratic elections now in all 50 states plus the District of Columbia that allocates the electors according to who won the state. And so I think we have bought into that vision now, and that is our, and it is the state's rights to do that under the Constitution. And so I think what you need, it seems to me, if you have a formula to put out there, is the electors have a right always to think about this and to decide. But I think they should, in their own conscience, decide if they should or not. And that would only happen, it seems to me, that post-election you got new information that the American people did not have before them, or the people of their state did not have before them during the election. And I think this fails. EJ is, I think, wrong. Well, he's not wrong on that because he didn't address that directly. But I think the Russian stuff, the stuff that has come out, we all sort of knew before. We had some more confirmation of it. But this is what the Clinton campaign put out constantly about her response to every leak was not to respond on the merits of the leak itself and what the, whether they never confirmed them or denied them until after the election. Of course, they are sort of now in the sense Russians have did it, but it was always the Russians did it, and so ignore this and focus on the Russians. So we knew this coming in. This is not new information.
All right, and we're going to get more into that information. But, Gary, how likely do you think Republican electors are likely to change their votes?
That's absolutely no likelihood whatsoever. This is an important exercise to talk about it and education. But that is not going to happen. We may have the one, Chris, I think his name is, in Texas seems like he's certainly going to flip. You may have one or two others. But the idea that you're going to get 37 committed Republicans to bow to Hollywood pressure and thousands of attack emails from liberals, et cetera, is nonsense.
Gary Gregg, he's director of the McConnell Center, University of Louisville, and author of Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College. Short break. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. As we talk about the Electoral College, which is voting today, college is a curious word because the electors do not come together to meet. They meet within their own states and state capitals and, of course, within the District of Columbia. Joining us now from Austin, Texas, is Republican elector Chris Suprin. Chris, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show. I understand you have decided not to vote for Donald Trump today. Tell us why.
Well, I think, Diane, that Mr. Trump has disqualified himself subjectively. When we look at his record on foreign policy and national security, he is was considered a threat to if he were president, according to 50 Republican national security and foreign policy experts. He's been an absolute demagogue for at least 18 months, and that hasn't changed since the election, where he continues to divide people based on race, where they worship, color of their skin, and so forth. But objectively, we know that from day one, his foreign interests would create a constitutional crisis. He would be in violation of the Emoluments Clause, and he would be earning money from foreign governments from day one. And that's unacceptable to both our founding fathers as well as me.
I gather you have asked for an intelligence briefing on Russia. What was the response you've had?
Well, I was signed on to a letter with several other Democratic electors who wanted to get that information about the CIA. That was denied, I believe, on Saturday by the Director of National Intelligence. But again, that's kind of a icing on the cake issue for me more than a fundamental issue right now. He fails the test otherwise. That just shows additionally, though, that his allegiance may not be with America.
So who do you plan to vote for today?
Certainly. There was an op-ed that I believe The Hill published a little while ago announcing that I will be voting for John Kasich. I know that previously he has said he doesn't want Electoral College members to do that. It's not that different, in my opinion, though, than what George Washington said more than 200 years ago. He had to be drafted into service as well. So I'm hoping we get the 37 votes to send this to the House and that they make a choice of John Kasich as well.
So tell me what the reaction has been to your decision.
Well, the reaction's been across the board. You know, I've received death threats, quite frankly, myself and my family, and wow. any number of personal attacks from people who are unhappy that I won't vote for Mr. Trump. And then on the other side, I've had people from across Dallas, across Texas, across the country, even in outside the country, who have said, this is great. This is restores my faith in America, that you will stand up and do what's right for your country. I have at least one person who came to me who can claim their genealogic lineage back to the American Revolution. And that person said, I think my ancestors would endorse your behavior and your work. So the blowback has been on both sides, and you take the good with the bad.
Chris, I also understand you were criticized by some media outlets for somehow misrepresenting yourself in the op-ed that you wrote. How so?
Well, there was a single news station here in the Dallas area that used either an unnamed source or no source at all that said Chris couldn't have gone to 9/11. That's been refuted. It's been validated by multiple independent sources. And I'm not sure when or if they're going to issue a retraction. In my case, it's a little bit like litter, though. When you put your trash in a trash can, everything stays nice and clean. But if you just throw paper out along the highway as you're driving, it creates a giant mess for other people to clean up. It's part of a wider plan to try and smear and distract from what I'm doing, talking about why Mr. Trump's not qualified.
Tell me what time you plan to vote today.
The Electoral College here in Texas, our delegation will meet at 2 o'clock this afternoon. We have a little bit of business to attend to before the actual voting, but I think we'll be done by 3 o'clock my time.
Do you think there will be others joining you?
Yes. I do not think I will be the only Republican today, but I can't give you specific numbers, obviously. From state to state, people have their own right to vote as they see fit. I just ask that they cast a vote of conscience and vote their principles.
Chris Subrin, he is from Austin, Texas. He is a Republican elector who will not vote for Donald Trump today. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
EJ, how many of those do you think there are out there?
Well, the honest answer is I have absolutely no idea. I suspect that Gary is right, that we're not going to see enough Trump electors defect to throw this into the House of Representatives.
37.
But I think what's going to be fascinating is if even a significant number, and I would put that as 5 or 6 electors bolt from Trump, it tells us that something special has happened here, that there is a particular concern about Donald Trump. And Gary made the point that, well, the Clinton people talked about Russia before this election. Two things about that. One is I've heard a critique of the Clinton campaign that they actually responded to all these emails, and they should have simply said, we're not responding to any of this. This is Russian intervention in the election. And they should have put it even more in the forefront. But second, it involves obviously a disagreement between Gary and me over how much the new information we got, the intelligence agencies explicitly saying, which they did not say before the election, that the Russians were intervening to elect Donald Trump. This is different from saying the Russians were intervening simply to mess up our electoral process. And it makes sense that they might have done that because, and Hillary Clinton made this point, but others have made this point too, Vladimir Putin really doesn't like Hillary Clinton because she spoke up about the rigging of the Russian election in Putin's favor. And so he intervened in this election. So, you know, we can argue about this. I suspect, assuming Trump wins today, we will still be arguing into the Trump term about what Putin's impact was and what we should do about it.
Danielle, how much do we know about how much Russia intervened with the election?
I mean, what we have are, you know, major national intelligence officials saying that they have confidence. I don't remember their exact phrase, but that they have confidence that Russia was involved in this and that people from the highest levels of Russia were involved in this. And beyond that, I'm not sure on the exact specifics of, you know, the mechanics of it. But it does seem from these people, from these people at the highest levels of our intelligence services, that Russia really was behind a lot of this.
Gary, are we ever going to know how much they did interfere, how they interfered, and to what extent they did, in effect, disrupt the election?
Yeah, no, I don't think, you know, elections are so complicated. If you're talking about just the first part of the intelligence brief, I don't have any idea whether the intelligence community will come out at some point. Most secrets come out at some point. We might know that. But elections are so complicated. I don't think you can isolate any one little part and say that caused the election to go the way it was. And I highly doubt it would be these leaks, frankly. The people that voted for Trump, I think, would have probably voted for Trump at the end of the day for a whole complicated lots of other reasons, economics, despair, concerns about Clinton, concerns about the last 8 years and the direction of the country. This is a change election. I'm not sure the Russians leaks had much to do with it.
It's a change election, by the way. We haven't even mentioned this number in which 2.8 million, at the last count, more people voted for Hillary Clinton than for Donald Trump. And just to Gary's point, I don't think the issue here is you have to prove that the Russian intervention is the one and only reason why the election came out the way it did. Of course, elections are decided by multiple factors. What's important is that we did have this intervention, which is a kind of intervention we have not, to our knowledge, ever seen before. And that really matters whether you think that this outcome is the result of one factor or 100 factors.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. And the one thing that I would add to both Gary and EJ is this interesting idea that during the election, there was talk of the election being, quote, rigged or hacked or whatever. I think there was a general idea in the back of some people's, you know, voters' minds that, oh, you know, maybe a voting machine could be hacked. That did not happen. But I saw a great headline, I believe it was on Slate, that said, you know, the votes weren't hacked, maybe, but the voters were hacked.
That was a very good piece.
Right, yeah. And I mean, so there's no way to quantify, really, whatever influence the Russian hacks did or did not have. Who can ever know, you know, what me knowing John Podesta's risotto recipe or what have you could have done to anybody's vote? We're certainly never going to know that.
All right. Here's an email from Niels. It is the responsibility of the electors to keep a demagogue from becoming president. This is their primary function. EJ, demagogue is a strong word. Do you subscribe to that word?
About Trump, I certainly do. And, you know, I think that here's something Gary and I probably agree on. We should be candid in saying that the system that we have, had really since the 1828 election, when all but two states elected electors by popular vote, has not seen the electors as having an independent role. In the same way, the founders foresaw it both in the Constitution itself and in the 12th Amendment, which altered the system. And those of us who are saying that maybe this time they should exercise their independent judgment have to be candid about that that long history. But I do think that Trump presents us with challenges and problems that no other candidate has ever presented us with, at least in my lifetime.
All right. And there is another email. Do the electors meet or otherwise communicate amongst themselves, either formally or informally, prior to their election day?
There's no rule that they can't. I mean, obviously, these Hamilton electors who were trying to drum up opposition to Trump have been in communication with electors. I spoke with an elector a couple of weeks ago who said she's gotten a lot of phone calls and been contacted by people. So, you know, there's no bar on their consulting with each other. They have the freedom to do that. They're not sealed off from the rest of us.
All right. And joining us now is Brett Schifalo, and I'd really like to know about your, quote, Hamilton electors group. Brett, tell us about it.
Yes, Diane, and thanks for having me. I've always been a big fan of yours.
Thank you.
Hamilton Electors was started when Michael Baca, a fellow elector in Colorado, and myself on November 9th decided that we had a moral imperative because of what we believe we were directed to do in Federalist 68 and the Constitution to stop Donald Trump because he is a demagogue, an unfit president, and may be influenced by foreign powers. And it's grown to a movement that today is having vigils in all 50 states and has thousands of volunteers and maybe, if we're lucky, 37 Republican electors voting for someone like John Kasich.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want you all to know Brett Schifalo is a Democratic elector and co-founder of the HamiltonElectors.com. How many Republican voters have you talked to, Brett?
I've spoken to dozens personally, and other electors and lawyers in my group have spoken to dozens more.
And who might you vote for?
I will probably, when I sit down, vote for John Kasich, because I want to encourage all Republican electors to put country before party. And I think the best way for me to ask them to do that is by modeling that behavior myself.
I gather that first you told the Seattle Times you might vote for Bernie Sanders. What changed your mind?
Well, for one, my main goal of voting for Bernie Sanders, if Hillary Clinton had won by 30 or 40 electoral votes, was to bring attention to the Electoral College and how Americans actually vote for president. Because so many people I talked to, even other electors at the beginning, didn't understand how the system worked. So that was just an opportunity for me to educate the American people. Obviously, what changed is Donald Trump won the preliminary vote for electors, and that presented an emergency situation that we had to respond to.
Brett Schifalo, Democratic elector, co-founder of HamiltonElectors.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And here's an email on this subject from Jerry in Michigan, who says, California has a population of 38 million plus and 55 electors, or 696,000 people per elector. Meanwhile, Wyoming has a population of 582,658 and 3 electors, or 194,219 people per elector. So, Wyoming people have 3.5 times as much influence about who becomes president. That's where the real problem is. How do you feel about that, Gary Gregg?
Yeah, well, take the extremes there, obviously, and it seems to be a disparity. Let me say it's no different disparity than the United States Senate. So under the same, and that's basically the difference there. And so under the same rules, you have to throw out the United States Senate as well. I just think there is a disparity there. There's no question about that. But there are lots of ways. We talk about the Electoral College, which we did on your show a few weeks ago. There are lots of ways to there's lots of good that the Electoral College brings that this math sort of offsets the math, including having very competitive elections, not allowing one state, which is California, which all of Hillary's victory. She won California by more than 4 million votes. She won win the nation by under 3 million votes. And so she won just Los Angeles by 1.2 million votes, which is the same margin that Trump wins in 11 battleground states all combined. So it gives us a diversity here. Michigan counts, Minnesota counts, Wisconsin counts, Pennsylvania counts, really cool rural voters count, urban voters count, and the like. And I think it gives us competitive elections, gives us rule of law kind of elections, gives us stops recounts, and does good for American democracy.
Gary Gregg, he's director of the McConnell Center at the University of Louisville and author of Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College. I'm sure you'll hear an opposing view from E.J. Dionne. Pardon me. When we come back, stay with us. And welcome back. Just before the break, Gary Gregg, who's the author of Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College, responded to an email citing the disparity in the number of electors per population that various states, California and Wyoming, have. EJ, it's your turn.
Right. Gary's a very thoughtful person, but I was disappointed that he did what so many defenders of the Electoral College are doing, which is he's acting as if there's something wrong if you're a Californian. He said, my God, if, Hillary Clinton's margin comes entirely out of California, therefore, there's something defective about her popular vote margin. If you drop California out, she doesn't have the popular vote lead. I could just as easily say that if we drop out all the states of the old Confederacy, Hillary Clinton wins the election by a landslide. A vote is a vote is a vote. And the fact that many Americans voluntarily choose to move to California, often in search of economic opportunity, are they supposed to lose some of their political influence because they have chosen to move to California as opposed to Wyoming or some other state? And I think this California point that defenders of the Electoral College keep making really underscores why it's an unfair system. There's nothing wrong with being from California.
Danielle.
Now, were I to play devil's advocate to EJ, what I would say is this thing, a great thing that a colleague of mine pointed out was the winner of the most total runs doesn't win the World Series. The person who wins the most games wins the World Series. You could lose the World Series and still have won the most runs. Now, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump campaigned as if the electors would vote winner take all at all of those states. Had they not done it that way, they would have campaigned more in California. They were playing the game the way that they thought the rules were set up. And to change it now, I realize these are not set rules, but it is the norms, and it is what the candidates thought going in.
Let me just flip that, and I want to give Gary, obviously, a chance to reply to me. I use a different baseball metaphor. This would be as if we determine the winner of a game not by the total number of runs scored, but by who wins how many innings, and some innings count for more than other innings. I agree. They knew what the rules were going in here. That's all true. But I think we would not like baseball if it depended as much as we do, or at least I do, if it depended on the number of innings won and the eighth inning mattered way more than the third inning.
All right, Fair Gary, enough. I'll give you a chance to get into this baseball metaphor.
I won't get into the baseball. I'll just defend myself for the people of California. Nothing wrong with being California at all. What's the difference in California is voting in ways that are really unrepresentative of the rest of the country. So Hillary wins 62% of the popular vote in California, which is the third highest in the country, only beat by Washington, D.C., which is she gets 91%, and Hawaii. If you look at the battleground states, they just look more like the rest of America voted. Down the line, there, it's a close race. It's a competitive race. California gets 20% of the electoral college vote needed to be president already. I think that's pretty good, and the offsets give us other valuable things in our democracy.
All right, now I want to go to Centerville, Virginia, and to George. You're on the air.
Awesome. Hello. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
I've tried to get a hold of you for so long, and I finally get you before you leave. Thank you.
Miss her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
You make my drives a lot better, and you guys really inform me and keep me in tune with everything.
I'm glad.
And I appreciate that. But my question is really, what is the point of the Electoral College? I mean, why do we vote if, like with this election, the popular vote went one way, but the Electoral College went the other way? It just seems like our votes don't really matter.
And that is the heart of the issue. Should the Electoral College continue? Gary.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's you know, it's really about the math. It's not about the electors right now. We're fighting about the electors being faithless, and it's, I'm like in some kind of a warp. For 20 years, I've been defending the Electoral College against people who have said the nightmare scenario is faithless electors. Now, so many of them want faithless electors. It's a shocking moment. But look, we get a good diverse representation across the country in these elections. They're competitive elections. The states matter. Federalism matters in our constitutional order. We get good diversity. The concentration of power we have in this country in all the media outlets centered in our major central cities. All of 60-some percent of all campaign cash comes from major urban areas. The candidates, as you can see, come from major urban areas almost all the time. And so the question is, do we really want to give all votes then to those major urban areas? And I don't think we necessarily do.
Well, you know, Gary again underscores there's a fear that these big metro areas will dominate the country, even if everybody happens to be moving there. He used the word diversity. There was a very good study that showed, given where minority populations are, African-Americans, Latinos in particular, they are underrepresented by the Electoral College system in the way it works. So if we want diversity, let's get every kind of diversity. And the best diversity is one person, one vote determining the winner of the election.
So you would do away with the Electoral College now?
I would. I wrote a column, I think, 16 years ago, and I've long believed the Electoral College was a bad system. Look, if we took seriously the vision of the founders, then the electors would be a deliberative body. They have not been a deliberative body since 1828.
Who are they?
Get the worst of all worlds, a body which is not deliberative. And it can fly in the face of the will of the people as measured by the popular vote. And by the way, if the national popular vote is not sacred and means nothing, why suddenly does the vote in the states, the same popular vote, mean so much? Obviously, you can say, well, state legislatures voted to pick the electors that way. I get that. But there's a real inconsistency in this argument that we should really, really care about the popular vote in one instance and completely ignore it in the case of the nation.
Danielle.
Right. And I just disagreed with EJ, and now I'm going to come back and agree with him on some of these points because, listen, I am a pretty educated person. When I have voted, I honestly don't know who these electors are. So if, as set up in Federalist 68, these electors are supposed to be the best and brightest among us and the people that are very smart and best know who should be leading us, I mean, I don't know if Jane Doe, who is the elector from Washington, D.C., is way smarter and better capable of doing this than I am. That is what I think is really fascinating here. We've sort of lost the spirit of the system, like EJ was saying, the deliberative part of the system.
And here's a tweet from Gail, who says, I live in Alabama. It always goes red. My vote for a Democratic president never counts. We are thinking of returning to Florida.
Well, there are people who, if they had any option at all with dual residency, chose the state they can live in. And that's, by the way, another criticism of the Electoral College, which is all of the campaigning goes on in about 10 states. That if you live in Utah or Massachusetts or Alabama, you ain't never going to see a candidate because they're not going to waste their time campaigning in your state. And most states are pretty clearly Republican or pretty clearly Democratic. So we don't have a national campaign. Nobody does campaign in the aforementioned California because they pretty much have assumed which way it's going to go correctly.
What would it take to do away with the Electoral College?
Well, it's not going to happen constitutionally, alas, because every small state has an interest in the current system because they're overrepresented. And so you won't get an amendment through. There is a movement called the National Popular Vote, which I have endorsed, where state legislatures, which they can do under the Constitution, are voting to pledge their electors to the winner of the popular vote.
And 11 states have already adopted that.
Right. And if states with a majority of the electors agreed to this compact, we would have a popular vote for president. I suspect Gary and others might sue and try to see if they could actually do this. But I am hoping this happens over time, because I don't see any hope of amending the Constitution directly, given the power of the small states.
All right. To Andrew in Chicago, Illinois, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I'm so honored to be here again. I just enjoyed your show so much.
Good.
To go back, and being from Chicago, I have reason to go back to the baseball metaphor this year, at least. I love the idea about the runs versus wins, because that's how it works. The other metaphor doesn't really work because, in fact, innings are not weighted. So that one doesn't really hold water.
But that's my point. Just to be clear, my point was it's worse than just innings won. It's innings won with some innings weighted more than others, which is what makes it similar to the Electoral College.
Right, but innings are not weighted, so it's not similar to the Electoral College.
Okay,
We're going to get into ERA soon. Go ahead, sir.
My question is, given the state of the country as it was being created, when the Electoral College was first put into place, the country was in a particular state, as far as development. And and since it's been put in, we've added a number of states. So going back to the disbursement of influence, is there, and trying to decide if the Electoral College should stay or go, is there anything that has happened, or it's the way the country has developed since the implementation of the Electoral College, that would help sway people's vote? Is there anything relevant that has changed that would negate or further support the use of an Electoral College?
Gary, has the country changed sufficiently since the adoption of the Electoral College to make us rethink its relevance?
Well, I think we've certainly changed a lot, but we've changed the system. So the system has changed as America has changed, and that's an important point. One, we can probably get behind, except for these people that are now arguing for faithless electors, which is shocking to me, is we can probably get behind a decision to, if we don't abolish Electoral College, just abolish the role of electors. There's no reason to actually have these electors except in a break glass kind of moment when it's a real national crisis. But we could just automatically give the electoral votes to the winner of the states and not even have to worry about this problem.
I don't know if that's an improvement, but at least it's more honest about the way the system tends to work. But I want to answer the caller's question about how the system has changed from the beginning. When the Republic was established in the first census of 1790, the ratio between the smallest and the largest state, the population ratio, was 13-1. Now the ratio between the smallest and largest state is 67-1. So the differences across states are even greater than they were when this system was first put in. And the whole orientation toward the states in the first place there are scholars who argue it gave benefits to the slave states, but also the smaller states, in order to join the Union, wanted incentives. We have since become a different country, but that shift in the ratio from 13-1 to 67-1 ought to give us pause. And I agree with Gary, it should give us pause about the Senate, even though the Constitution says we can't really change the Senate.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And are you wanting to jump in, Danielle?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would add to all of this. I can't really argue against a lot of it. What I would add in is one of the biggest changes that we've seen and we continue to see is the very fast, very free flow of information. You know, back when the nation was founded, your average Joe Blow, and I do say Joe very specifically because it was only men who got to vote, white men especially, that your average farmer couldn't get out a computer and learn Hillary Clinton's entire platform and Donald Trump's entire platform. Your average voter today can sit and deliberate and think about who they want to vote for. They don't need an elector as an intermediary.
All right. To Susan in Peoria, Illinois. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The media, The media is widely presenting the intrusion of the Russians on this election as an unprecedented intrusion by a foreign power. Would the presenters please discuss the Iran hostage deal brokered by George H. Bush with the Iranians to not release the American hostages prior to the election to make President Carter seem more effective in return for not releasing the hostages earlier? Iran was promised weapons, and the hostages were then released symbolically on Inauguration Day.
So it's not the first time a foreign entity may have affected the election.
Yeah, the Iran thing is complicated. I don't want to go into all of the details there, but it's true the Iranians held the hostages until after Ronald Reagan got inaugurated. No, foreign powers have had an interest in the outcomes of our elections for a long time. The 1940 election, Philip Roth wrote a great book imagining an alternative history, but it was clear in the 1940 election, the Allies and the Axis, the Germans and the British in particular, had a great interest in the outcome of our election. But this is something new in terms of what is available to a foreign power through our information system. And it's also a fact that we know far more facts about this intervention, thanks to the intelligence agencies. And President Obama has said rightly that he's going to try to get as much information out before his term is over. And I hope, as several senators have suggested in both parties, there's a select committee that investigates this even more. So, but the caller has a point that foreign powers do have an interest in the outcome of American outcomes of American elections.
And final comment from Jason in New Braunfels, Texas, who says trying to overturn the Electoral College vote looks really bad for Democrats. The rules are the rules. You get 270 on Election Day, you win. Discussion over, Danielle?
Listen, I am totally agnostic in this fight, of course, as an unbiased reporter. But, you know, listen, I think it is very important to note that times change. And as we were saying, you know, population ratios change, the flow of information changes. Therefore, it is not unreasonable to argue that maybe the way that we govern changes.
All right. And we'll leave it at that. Danielle Kurtzleben, she's a reporter for NPR. E.J. Dionne, he's with The Washington Post. And Gary Gregg, he is the author of Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College. Thank you so much.
Joy to be with you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.